This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Our national memory of World War II offers glorified and often poetic images of the battles and the people who fought them.
0545. On the dot. The battleships, cruisers, and destroyers, already at work for 2 days, begin their final softening up of the beaches. It's thrilling to see the waves of planes appear out of the east and the north, sweep down on the island and loose their bombs.
We remember it as America's good war, fought by the greatest generation, and we properly honor the men and women who courageously risked and lost their lives in the cause. But there were other acts of heroism that many Americans viewed differently. For pacifists, World War II wasn't about standing up to Hitler. It was about standing up to the draft board, testing their beliefs, showing the courage of their convictions. Ned Arnett was one of those young men. He was raised a pacifist Quaker, and though he struggled with his decision, he did become a conscientious objector during World War II. That's the focus of his book, A Different Kind of War Story. And Ned Arnett joins us in the studio now. Ned, welcome. Good to have you here.
Frank, it's great to be on here. And I do wish to speak up for the thousands, small number, but still thousands of people who did not go along with the general national support of the war.
Well, let me talk to you about that, because initially, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, I understand that you did think that the thing to do was to go and serve, right?
From time to time, I thought of taking that way. I would say that most of the people my age that I've talked to, most of the men had to think through the decision as to whether to remember what they learned in Sunday school or what they were learning from the national propaganda to support the war effort. And I've talked to many a combat veteran who has told me that if he'd known what he was getting into, he would have wished that he had taken a different course of decision.
Well, you call it propaganda, but this was a shocking and a painful attack on American soil, and lives were lost, American blood was shed. That was real.
No question whatsoever about that. And although I was brought up in a pacifist family and in a religious group that was solidly anti-war, I couldn't see a simple answer to Pearl Harbor. And for a while, I considered going all the way and joining the Marines rather than what looked like a somewhat less committed point of view. I did have an opportunity to get out of the problem of conscientious objection by taking a position, Lieutenant J.G. in the Navy, which was offered to me when it looked as though I was going to be sent to camp for conscientious objectors. But when I talked it over with the elder members in my church, which had a long history of standing up to war, I decided I'd just bite the bullet and go to camp as I would be assigned by the draft board.
Well, what was it that they told you, those Quaker elders, that changed your mind?
They simply said, you're going to be part of the war effort if you do that. And I would say the essence of the anti-war position is that war is the enemy. War looks like a great big mental disease. And if you were in the middle of some sort of a neighborhood or family scrap, you could see how things take on a life of their own, and it's very difficult to break up the pattern. I think there's a growing understanding that any kind of solution which ends up killing 15 million or in World War II, 55 million people. That's a pretty poor solution to things.
Well, what would you say to those who would say, yeah, but there were millions and millions who were killed because of what our enemies were doing, and had we not intervened militarily, millions and millions and millions more would have died?
I just simply have to go back and say again that it's not a totally satisfactory answer, but war is the enemy, and when are you going to say no to that? It's easy enough to say, talk about peace in peacetime. The question is, what do you say about it when the tide is all in the other direction?
You had to do this, of course, in the 1940s. You had to go to your draft board then and make your case. What was that experience like for you?
Well, my draft board was used to Quakers. And
you're in Philadelphia, right?
That was the Quaker City and the Quaker State. And my draft board was made up, as far as I know, of volunteers. They had boys in the service, and they got angry letters from neighbors who were thought that every person should be in the fighting forces. But they were very just, and I have no complaints. I would go to the draft board when asked and try again and again to explain my position. I had to fill out form after form after form, and that is always the case. I was lucky enough to be born in the United States, where there was a means that had been hammered out for dealing with conscientious objectors.
Now, it went well for you, but I guess there may have been other places in the country. As you said, Philadelphia, lots of Quakers, they're used to dealing with it. Other places in the country, maybe not so easy for COs?
It was not so easy for many people, and they particularly for married COs. If there were any children, we were not paid a single cent by the government. We were essentially under conscription doing slave labor. And so it could be pretty hard economically and hard psychologically if you were in a small southern or a small, very patriotic town where everybody considered that you were either a coward or virtually a spy or a traitor.
Yeah. What was your assignment?
My assignment, I was drafted and sent to the induction center in Big Flats, New York, where all of the COs who were to be handled by the Quaker Central Committee were sent. And I decided when I got there that I was not going to let this experience undermine me and make me cynical about the world. I was in the hands of Uncle Sam, and I wanted to see this beautiful country. So I would, every time I was reassigned to a project or a different place, I'd immediately put in for a transfer, which would take about 6 months to get through, and I'd be doing something else. So I think the most interesting things that I did were to get myself assigned to the Forest Service smoke jumpers in Missoula, Montana, which was worked out very well by the Forest Service technique for parachuting people into really remote areas of the Rocky Mountains, where if there were a lightning strike that had started a fire, if you got to it good and early, you could stop it with just an acre or so. Whereas,
well, you don't have to ask you. The idea of being a smoke jumper, we're jumping into forest fires, and that to me presents two problems. Number one, a fire, and number two, the forest. There's a picture of you stuck in the trees here. It's a bad place to be jumping with a parachute, I think.
Absolutely. And the Forest Service had done an excellent job during the previous few years of working out the details of handling all of the hazards of jumping people into the forest, which might be on fire.
Well, and interestingly enough, not just lightning strikes, because at this time there was real concern that the Japanese had a plan for starting fires in
those forests. You're absolutely right. The Japanese had developed, according to American intelligence, they discovered there was a plan to try to set the whole northwestern part of the country on fire by sending over fire balloons. These would be carried by the upper winds across the Pacific and land in the forest and set things off on fire. Turned out that mostly that project was a big flop, that it didn't do anything like it, but the Forest Service recruited us COs to be prepared to deal with it. Parenthetically, the only lives that were lost on the American mainland from fire balloons were one Sunday afternoon, a Sunday school group in Oregon were going to their campground and saw some funny thing by the side of the road, and the preacher and five of his students went to look at it. It blew up and killed all of them, and those people represent the total number of American citizens who were killed on their home soil by the fire balloons.
Wow. So you, and you, as you said, put in for transfers. You tried to see the country and managed to see Poland as well.
I did indeed. Actually, the war was over, but President Truman had said that the last CO would not be released from service. The first CO would not be released until the last GI was released. And so even though the war was over, I signed up on a project to take 1,200 wild horses that had been corralled from the northern plains across to Poland. Not surprisingly, every horse in Europe, as far as I know, had long since been eaten, and Polish agriculture depended on horses at that time. So imagine 1,200 wild horses in the hold of a big ship and getting them safely across the ocean and released for use in Poland. Well, and that's what we did, and two of the most interesting weeks of my life were spent in Poland.
When you were a CO and you were going from place to place, I'm wondering how you were treated. Did you endure harassment? Did people treat you respectfully? How did it go?
Well, in camp, a CO camp was a very live and let live sort of place, but mostly patriotic neighbors were anything but pleased to have a CO camp nearby, and people coming or going on leave or furlough very frequently could be beaten up just simply because they were coming or going to camp.
Did you think about when you made your decision to apply for CO status, the impact that it would have on your life, what your neighbors might think, whether it would affect your job opportunities afterward? I mean, was that all part of the thought process going in?
Yes, it did. I'd been raised in a pacifist family in which had been very close to the really brutal treatment allotted to COs in the First World War.
Your father was a CO.
My father would have been a CO, but if he'd had a chance to do it over, but he was a lieutenant in the medical corps. But I was raised on horror stories, and I was expecting the very worst when the time came to sign up after we entered the war. I was very pleased and remain so that the United States is full of people who really respect freedom of religion, and I never suffered a bit from being beaten up. I had stones and tomatoes thrown at me or something like that, but nothing compared to the really brutal, cruel treatment that happened to COs in World War One.
So you faced that, and it is certainly a kind of courage to face the possibility of that kind of treatment based on a philosophical or religious conviction, and that's a kind of courage, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It didn't feel that way at the time. I must say I felt over and over as we went through the war and were treated kindly by many people. My feeling of God bless America certainly came to the fore, and I was glad that I had a chance to serve without facing the matter of killing someone else or supporting what is, in many ways, one of the most evil institutions that mankind has developed.
How is it for conscientious objectors today, do you think?
Well, there isn't anything to object to as far as conscription is concerned. That's a big difference. But the place where conscientious objection shows up is in people who enter the armed forces and who gradually, through one experience and another, realize that they are conscientiously opposed to what they're being trained to do. All of the armed services have regular protocols for dealing with this, and I wasn't able to obtain actual numbers for how many people had been dismissed by the armed services that way. But this is something which is accepted. People realized after the Nuremberg trials that they were prosecuting people who they thought might have been conscientious objectors if they'd done the right thing. And the United Nations Commission on Human Rights has developed protocols which many nations have signed on to. I think about half the young men who were, the young people who are being drafted in Germany right now, almost half of them want to sign up as conscientious objectors. There is still quite a few countries where you go to jail, or maybe worse if you're a CO, but it is astounding what has happened.
It seems to me the population at large is also implicated in this, in how they view their patriotic duty and whether they feel cowed or pressured into supporting a military effort when in their mind and in their conscience and heart they don't, but are afraid to stand up to their neighbors. Is that a form of conscientious objection?
Well, people have the total range of feelings about it. I think one of the big surprises to me, having been raised in the peace movement back in the 30s and 40s, I really had my doubts as to how effective conscientious objection or pacifism would be. And what's happened since is the massive success, nonviolent direct action of nonviolent protest, the three big successes, the dissolution of the British Empire under the leadership of Mahatma Gandhi, an enormously powerful man who was guided completely by principles of nonviolent direct action, which were picked up in the United States by the civil rights movement. They couldn't possibly have won any other way. They were outgunned. All of the pressure was against it. And finally, the Soviet Union, after years of under a monster government, they somehow or other, they organized nonviolent protest, brought down the Soviet Union. So I would say the way it's turned out has been very strongly in favor of the power of nonviolent direct action.
And you know, Ned, you point out three of the most powerful examples of effective nonviolence and political strategy in the 20th century. And even during World War II, the Danes were successful in saving the lives of 7,000 Jews in their country by first surrendering and then offering nonviolent subversion that ultimately forced the Wehrmacht to close up shop in Denmark. And that's another example that's rarely told. But people will often go back to World War II and say, yeah, how would you stop Hitler? And I guess the question is, ask the Danes. Or ask Ned Arnett, who's written a book called A Different Kind of War Story. Ned, thanks so much for being on the program.
It was a delight to be with you.
Ned Arnett, author of A Different Kind of War Story, chronicles his time as a conscientious objector in World War II. Just ahead, Olympia Stone tells the story of the cardboard Bernini. Stay tuned.